I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is Tech Central. Now, my next guest probably doesn't need much introduction, especially to captains of industry in South Africa. Dr. Dwart De Silva, businessman, advisor, ex-banker, current chairman of Huge Group. Dwart, we've known each other for many years, and I'm probably missing many, if not most, of the hats that you've worn over that period of time. I was trying to remember this morning ahead of this podcast when we first actually met, and I think it was in Diagonal Street at Merrill Lynch's offices, when I was a green around the gills journalist straight out of journ school, working at the Financial Mail. And I came to see you to talk about these big, scary IT companies like Versatel and Dimension Data. And you very kindly spent a considerable amount of time with me teaching me about these companies and going through their annual reports and talking about their opportunities, etc. That feels like a bit of a lifetime ago now, though. We did meet at Merrill Lynch's offices in downtown Joburg, didn't we?
That's right. It probably wasn't even Merrill Lynch. It was probably Smith, Borkham, Hare, Merrill
yes.
Lynch.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Before Merrill Lynch came in and bought it, right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, it started off as Davis, Borkham, Hare. They did a deal in London. Then Merrill Lynch bought that investment bank in London, which had a 50% stake in Davis, Borkham, Hare. And then Merrill Lynch decided to take it wholly owned, as international organizations like to do.
Yeah, for sure. And you were a director at Merrill Lynch. You worked your way up into the directorship position. But I remember most, you produced these amazing reports on IT companies at the time. And Dimension Data was one of them. I'm going to be talking about Dimension Data in some detail today. But companies like Udata and Versatel, you produced these fat reports. I think there were 100 pages or more each, with a lovely cartoon on the cover of each of them. And they were great reading. But a long time ago, and the industry's changed dramatically since then. Do you still keep in touch with all those guys in the IT industry that which you met and no doubt made friends with back in those days?
Probably most of them. I did start in the industry in 1994. The IT sector didn't exist. Yeah. It was a subsector of the electrical and electronics industry sector.
That's right.
The Financial Mail defined it, and the JSE defined it at the time.
I remember that. And there were a couple of companies listed. Versatel was one of them, Qdata. Who were some of the other names around in there? Roynet was around, I think, at the time, but they were more of an industrial group.
I actually dug up an old report that I did. There was Roynet, there was Ultron. I produced my first report on what I called the IT sector, and I've just pulled it out. It was in March 1995, and in that report I've got companies like Dimension Data, ISG, Versatel, Qdata, Siltec, and FinTech, which was part of the Ultron group. I actually started as the motor analyst. So my very, very first report was on Toyota, which had a market cap of 4 billion rand and no shareholders.
Oh, well. Okay. So how did you progress into the IT space? Was it something that interested you?
Well, I was hired because of my industry background. I've got an engineering education, and I'd spent some time in management consulting, specifically Accenture, Anderson Consulting in those days. And they were kind of experimenting with broadening research capability outside of just chartered accountants. I remember interviewing for it, and my to-be boss was a little bit concerned that I wasn't an accountant. And I expressed to him, I said, look, come in, accounts one will probably take me a day, accounts two days. Count three is harder, probably take me a week to review. he took the gamble, and I think it did become a benchmark in the future that actually people outside of accounting can become an analyst because of the industry background. So it made sense that I look after industrial stocks. So I was looking at GDFI stocks, non-consumer stocks, and it just so happened that electrical engineering and motor, and eventually I became the diversified analyst as well, all form part of that subsector. IT was just simply happened to be a component of that, which my boss told me, please stop worrying about the small fry, and let's concentrate on the decent-sized companies like Roynet and Ultron, where we at least can make some money from trading these stocks.
Yeah. And one of those small fry was, of course, Dimension Data, which would go on, I think, at one point to be the most valuable company by market cap on the JSE.
Certainly, I remember that Dimension Data, I can't remember the exact numbers. Mm-hmm. When I started analyzing Dimension Data, it had a market capitalization of 400 million rand, profit after tax of 20 million rand, and turnover of about 400 million rand. So it was on a 20 PE, which everyone thought was crazy. They had listed in 1987 with them, and it traded, I think, for about 5 years below their listing price.
Wow.
So it was kind of tiny. I think the market cap of Dimension Data exceeded all the mining companies put together.
Wow. At the peak.
At the peak before they all delisted.
Yeah, before the dot-com crash happened and took down the IT sector with it.
That's right.
Yeah.
There was a grouping of them that were kind of developing the market, and I would have classified Versatel in the same category. Mm-hmm. ISG was a little bit different. You know, if you recall, IBM had pulled out the country and then spun out its business, calling it ISG, and that had then gone to market and had listed with IBM as a 50% shareholder, then relisted as IBM post-sanctions period.
I remember that, ISG. They were also known as ISM at one point, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
Yeah.
Management effectively made a lot of money out of that, but they were the biggest company on the sector and primarily at the time a hardware producer. There was Siltec, which is effectively the HP distributor. Again, a spin-out of the sanctioned era. So Siltec was the HP agency and then had a 48% stake in another listed business called Q-Data.
Ah, yes. Q-Data. Piet den Boer.
Piet and Paul was his brother who was a CFO, correct?
Paul den Boer. Yes. Okay. He was a real character, and of course, Versatel ended up buying Q-Data, I think in the late 1990s or the early 2000s. Of course, it eventually became part of Telkom, but I remember there was a bit of rivalry between the CEO of Versatel at the time, that was a man by the name of Roo Marnitz, and Jeremy Ord, who was leading Dimension Data at the time. They really were neck and neck at one stage in terms of their size in the IT market here in South Africa, weren't they?
Well, that's right. They both landed up being Cisco distributors internationally. They both used their paper effectively, neck and neck. And at a time, I remember anecdotally, I was told that someone went to Cisco and said, you know, who are your two biggest distributors? And through the acquisitions that Dimension and Data had made, in particular Datacraft and others, they were number one. And number two was Versatel, that became PQ Holdings, had bought something called Telemation and others overseas. Mm. And someone came up with the idea and said, you know, let's create a mega Cisco distributor. And the discussion actually, as I understand it, probably started with Versatel looking at buying DD. That didn't go far. Then it was a merger discussion. And then I don't really think that the chemistry gelled.
Cultures are so different.
Roo is an incredibly smart man, and as are the Dimension Data, but culturally, you know, I don't think that they could coexist. So Roo did the smart thing. And the crazy thing, I believe that in terms of the person who made the most money out of selling Dimension Data shares was Roo Marnitz, not Jeremy Ord. Because he sold it for X. By the time Two Dimension Data got shares in consideration for the sale, and then disposed of those shares at 2x. And it really worked out to be a very, very big number. I was already not an analyst, and I picked up in the press that ExecuJet, which was also a Roo Marnitz company at the time, had just placed a massive $1 billion order for additional aircraft.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, where's the capital raise coming from this? And I phoned up Roo and I said, well, what's going on? And he didn't tell me, but I quickly worked out that the money was coming from a disposal.
Interesting. Now, Roo Marnitz, he ended up leaving the company in the end. There was an acquisition. They bought a company in Germany, I think, called Comparex, and then a new CEO came on board. His name slipped my mind. I don't know if you remember his name.
So the story was Persitel were the agencies for Hitachi in South Africa.
Mainframes, yes.
It was the only country in the world where Hitachi had a higher market share than IBM. And the reason for that was Roo Marnitz. The reason for that was also sanctions. So Roo Marnitz sold directly to government agencies. He then used his aircraft company to guarantee turnaround time of 24 hours. Uh-huh. So that was the initial foray. Then he broadened out. He bought Telemation, which was the Cisco business. But the agency, the German agency for Hitachi in Germany was Comparex.
Yeah.
So he bought that too. So they were also a Hitachi agent in Germany of the Japanese equipment.
Interesting. Hitachi, yeah. I don't think anyone outside of South Africa knows that Hitachi was ever in mainframe business.
That's right. And the gentleman you're thinking of was his chief operating officer. It was Rian du Plessis.
Rian du Plessis, that's a name. I wonder where he is today.
So Roo Marnitz retired.
Yeah.
He was probably a more advanced age than most. And I know he had some personal issues. And I heard that he'd settled in Botswana, he's come back. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's probably in his 80s now.
Yeah.
So Rian essentially took over. Of course, they had sold the Golden Goose business. So what they were left was actually the base of Hitachi and related. So Rian essentially inherited that, moved overseas. Then there was a bit of the shareholders. He wanted to embark on an acquisition campaign, following suit what Roo had done and expanding the business again, Comparex too. The shareholders kind of cut him off, and he had to – essentially, he bought out the European businesses. Comparex became the South African business, eventually landed up in Telkom because they had to unbundle. And Rian was forced or encouraged strongly to pay back the cash in the center as a dividend. Investec led that charge as an active shareholder in the business. Rian, a few years later, came back in Pumalela, in the horse racing business. He studied with Marcus Huerster. They did accounting together at Stellenbosch. And Marcus wasn't through Steinhoff, but in his personal capacity was big into the horse racing. And he asked Rian to come and run it for him, which he did. When the whole scandal broke out, Rian basically decided that he should step down from Malala.
Interesting. And then, of course, there was Peter Watt who took over that business, and he led it into Business Connection, the merger with the Mopatlane twins, and eventually it was sold into Telkom, where it sits today.
Yeah, Peter Watt, of course, my first encounter with Peter Watt was when he was the chief executive officer under Bill Fenter in Altron, whom I had a very, very interesting and long-term relationship with him and the family. That is worthy of a soap opera.
Eduard, I'm starting to think we're going to be sitting here until the sun sets today, but we should probably get on track and talk a little bit about Dimension Data, which is actually the reason we're chatting today. It flows from a piece that I published on Tech Central a couple of weeks ago now. Was it last week? It could have been the week before, about Jeremy Ord stepping down as executive chairman and leaving the group, which he's been with since 1987, I think. He's listed as a founder, although I think he only joined the group a year or two after it was started. But I think it's fair to call him a founder, given how intensely involved he was in the business for basically since its founding back in the mid-1980s. When did you first meet Jeremy?
So I met Jeremy in 1994 when I joined the industry, and I met him and the entire team at the Dimension Data Oval. Which was a little bit further from their current offices.
In Epsom Downs, yes.
With the Epsom Downs, that's right, with a market cap of 400 million rand, and I met his team, and a very impressive and broad-based team. And there were probably a dozen executives at the time that formed the foundation, which was I think the differentiator between him and the other companies, and that was the quality and the depth of the team that they had.
Yeah, yeah. So who were some of the guys who were there at the time? Who did you meet with apart from Jeremy?
So Jeremy, obviously, a real face of the business. But the other agenda, I spent a lot of time with Malcolm Rutherford, who was the financial director, Peter Hurd, and Doc Watson, and there were a variety of other people that, as they made acquisitions, that came on board.
Yeah.
And Richard Kane was very, very instrumental. So and there were a lot of ex-Accenture Anderson Consulting colleagues that had joined Dimension Data. So there were dozens of people that I really knew in the business at various management levels.
Yeah.
But Malcolm Rutherford being the CFO was my primary contact.
Yeah.
Richard came in terms of strategic evolution of the business and in terms of the direction in which Dimension was a very important person. And Jeremy, of course. Those are the three people that I spent considerable amount of time.
Yeah, we were stomping those same grounds, I think, around the mid to late 1990s. I remember meeting Jeremy at those Epsom Downs offices as well for the first time, probably in around 94, 95. And Richard Kame spent a lot of time with me as well, taking me through the business, as I'm sure he did with you and everyone else he met with. But I was always amazed how Richard always took the time. I had a regular meeting with him. I think it was a monthly or quarterly meeting where I'd go through to their offices in Epsom Downs and sit with him for an hour and a half, and he'd take me through everything that was happening in the industry and Didata strategy and where they were going, et cetera, et cetera. And I still value that time with Richard today. And he's obviously gone off and done very successful things outside of the Dimension Data Group since. But I think that's one of the interesting things. And I think you brought it up in your in a recent post you did on LinkedIn about Jeremy's leaving the group and the impact he's had on the economy and the IT sector here in South Africa. But I think the key message out of this is just how many strong, capable business people came out of this group and have gone on to do amazing things.
Yeah, look, I mean, what they've done there is absolutely incredible. And, you know, I was saddened to see Jeremy leaving. To me, it's a little bit like Stephen Kosoff leaving Investec. You know, there comes a time. Mm. But, you know, when the founders leave the business, it becomes something else. The same thing goes for Rand Merchant Bank. You know, these are absolute legends that created and built an institution that is a benchmark in that particular sector. So it really is fantastic. And as I said, some of those executives have gone on to do some incredible things. Malcolm Rutherford, for instance, is the chairman of Crooks Brothers, and he's gone and created another career in agriculture. Richard Kame is the founder of Dark Fiber Africa and Vumatel. Now, the last I checked, Remgro have valued those assets close to 10 billion rand. Mm. Might be a couple of years late. And Richard did start those from scratch. David Frankel went on to become to set up a private equity business in the US that was an early investor in Uber. And so he has done incredibly well. And just for reference, David Frankel was one of the founders of Internet Solutions. Mm. It was one of the acquisitions that Dimension Data made and brought on board. Funnily enough, I just went back on my report and I was amazed because I'd forgotten that Dimension Data bought an early stake in Internet Solutions for 12.5 million rand, 25% stake.
Wow.
Subsequently, less than a year later, paid 375 million rand for the next 75%, which was crazy because none of those founders, the Upchurchs, Frankels, etc., were all sub 30 at the time.
Absolutely amazing, yeah. And even then, that 375 million rand in hindsight was probably a steal.
It was, but, you know, Internet Solutions was you know, if you use accounting measures, ridiculously valued. You know, if you look at the value investors, they would have gone, you know, these guys have lost their mind. But it was interesting. Dimension Data, in the acquisition strategy, and if you go back, what they did is they always bought a small little stake, and they were quite happy to pay for their value and an increased valuation thereafter once they've tested the chemistry, once they were had made sure that the investment was going to fit. So they did that with investment internet solutions. They did it with the Australian acquisition called Comtech. They even did that with Datacraft. I guess where the wheels came off was when they made the US acquisition.
Yes, no due diligence done.
Well, you know, I know that there were two executives, you know, they had a mountain of money, and I don't think that was the big issue. Mm-hmm. I think the big issue was understanding what we're good at. And what Dimension Data was good at operating services-based companies in emerging markets. And I'll put Europe into that. The U.S. is a different market. There are very few South Africans who've been successful in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's a different culture. It's a different approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that we all would like to go there. It's a little bit like South Africans going to Australia. Dimension Data were successful in Australia, but I think, by the way, buying a company founded by ex-South Africans, but I think if you look, even Discovery really have not made a mark in the US. It's hard.
It's a very tough market, yeah. Very, very tough market.
Rue Miners was about, before he did the Dimension Data deal, was going to do buy a big Cisco distributor in South America. Mm-hmm. And because the transaction Dimension Data went through, that transaction never materialized. I would suggest that Dimension Data would have done a lot better for themselves following through on that than going for a common language. And that was the reason they felt more comfortable there than in South America.
Yeah.
I think culturally and from a business point of view, they would have been better equipped to deal in South America than in the US.
Yeah.
Everything is perfect in hindsight.
I remember talking to Jeremy about this actually not that long ago. Last year sometime I had an interview with him and I brought up, I think the company was called Proxicom, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
Proxicom. And they got into a bidding war with Compaq, which was later bought by Hewlett-Packard. And the price was being driven up and up and up and up through this bidding war with Compaq at the peak of the dot-com bubble when valuations were way out of kilter. And they ended up paying so much for Proxicom that it didn't make any sense whatsoever.
As I say, I mean, the valuation, let's just remember that they raised almost £1 billion on their IPO in London. So they had probably raised money on and inflated it. So they had the firepower.
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, one has to be careful of auction fever and chasing valuations up. I do believe that they had the competency and the advisors. Just happened to be my old house, Merrill Lynch, that were advising them.
Okay.
The competency. And I think the valuations would have been within their capability. I think a couple of things happened. I think one is Y2K came and went and the market simply vaporized and that demand just froze out. So the business just went away. And so I think that had a material. And then I think that Proxicom, one of the key issues I think it was a Mexican chap that had actually founded the business, had entered into a multiplicity of long-term leases on property, which was really an albatross around their neck. Brett Dawson actually was at some point, because Brett was hired from National Brands and then landed up running investments, internet solutions, and then was seconded into the United States to go and fix this up. And literally it was a fix-up job. And the fix-up was probably shutting down all of these offices. And that landed up really chewing up a lot of that capital that Dimension Data had. But if one goes fundamentally, I think the idea of going to the US was attractive. You know, you were going to go to the hub where technology was evolving. It was English speaking. But it was a mirage, because I don't think South Africans are good at doing business in the US.
Do you think it was a bit of hubris as well? I mean, these guys were celebrated at home. Jeremy was on the front cover of business magazines being lauded as this brilliant businessman who's taking this South African company global. There was a lot of positive PR around them. They'd just come off this very, very successful listing in London. Do you think there was some hubris behind this that they just said, we're invincible, we can do whatever we want?
We're all human, you know. I remember the publicity I used to get. You know, you start believing that anything's possible. So, you know, I'd imagine that there was a little bit of that. But, you know, it was also the go-go days. You know, it was
Yeah.
A use it or lose it. You know, a lot of people used to complain that it's not rocket science to issue paper on a high multiple and buy earnings on a low multiple. Correct. But if you don't do it, you're going to be on a low multiple, and therefore you can't. So there was almost, there is that momentum that you need to keep up. And the problem is you go, the size of your acquisition needs to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
So,
as I say, in hindsight, it all looks pretty obvious. You know, they did the best job that they could. And the reality is that Dimension Data did a little bit like Cisco. At the peak, I think Cisco almost peaked at $1 trillion market cap. And I think it was the first to almost touch that level. They then collapsed to a measly $50 billion. And then today, Cisco is still a considerable and a substantial company at probably $250-300 billion, which says it's still a good company. It just says that the valuations don't necessarily reflect the real value inherent in the business. So at a point in time, Dimension Data was overvalued.
Yes.
I think it entered even the FTSE index for a couple of days. Remember, the share spiked on an index trade. I think the share went from 75 to 100 rand on an index spike. And that gave it a market cap, if I'm not mistaken, of 100 billion rand when it was 5 rand to the dollar.
Yes, yes. No, it was an absolute remarkable time. But it all came unstuck after 2000. There was the Proxicom, there was the dot-com crash. The shares plunged, and Dimension Data actually got into a lot of trouble. I seem to recall that they built that huge palatial campus in Bryanston, which they have now sold. As part of a BE deal. But that campus almost became an albatross around their neck at one point. I think it almost sank them.
Yeah, look, they had a lease. And as far as I know, it was always off balance sheet in any case. You know, so the reality is, you know, you predicting the future and your space requirements is always tricky. So it did become a liability. I mean, Sasol was not that different a year ago. They've got that monumental building. I think at a point in time, you know, when their share price collapsed, the building was almost worth more than the business.
Yes.
So I don't think that was the issue. If you looked at Dimension Data, it did look like their balance sheet was okay. But the problem was at that time, if I recall, they had stakes in entities that had minority shareholders like Datacroft. And so they didn't have access to money where they needed it. So they did go and get themselves a loan from Mr. Johan Rupert, and that is how Remgro landed up being a shareholder in Dimension Data, because that was a convertible loan, and I think it converted to more equity than they wanted. You know, that is always the problem. You know, as an entrepreneur, as a CEO, you know, you're always bullish about your story. In fact, you shouldn't even be a CEO if you're not. So you sell a good story. Someone lends you money and says, okay, if you don't make your targets, well, then the conversion's going to be punitive. And it was. So Remgro landed up actually taking up less than they were entitled to. If I'm not mistaken, again, they went in below 30, so they didn't have to make an offer to minorities. And it was through Remgro that NTNT landed up coming in and taking the stake in Dimension Data.
Oh, yes. How did that happen?
Well, I wasn't in the market, I'm led to believe. Remgro certainly sold their stake to NTNT. I'm led to believe that Remgro led those discussions in terms of liquidating its position. And then NTNT were enthralled by the prospect of Datacroft, which, of course, is predominantly an Asian business.
Yeah.
So for them, it was a cheap entry into the group and a cheap entry into Datacroft. And then there was a sequence of trials. So they made an offer for Remgro, and I think they – for Remgro's stake, and then they made an offer to everyone else and eventually landed up taking the business private under their banner in a sequence of steps.
That was around 2010, if I recall correctly, 24 billion rand deal. I was really surprised personally that that Jeremy stuck around post that NTT deal. It would have seemed to me to be the obvious place to exit, but he didn't. He stayed on. He stayed on in an executive capacity as executive chairman of the group. So I suppose it's always difficult to know when, as a founder of a business, as a leader, the leader of a business for many, many years, when is the right time to go? What do you think of the fact that he did stick around for so long?
Jeremy is an incredibly, proud person, and, he had obviously marketed the business. He was, I'm sure, personally disappointed in terms of where the valuation had landed up.
Yeah.
And I believe that certainly it wasn't a financial requirement, because, rumor has it that he's done reasonably well for himself. I believe he stuck around because he wanted, it was his baby, and he believed and he felt a sense of ownership and obligation to make sure that it was on sound footing. And he appointed numerous subsequent operational people, whether it was Brett Dawson or Jason Goodall, which were all people that Jeremy personally appointed, in terms of being the job and supporting it. So I believe that certainly was a very strong motivation. I think in later years, and I think it was in the public domain that it, and in fact, NTNT at some point in time said, that South Africa, Africa, and the Middle East perhaps were not core businesses for them. And the speculation is that Jeremy and the team were going to lead a management buy-in rather than buy-out. And I do believe that, in recent years, that probably would have been also a motivator. I think, of course, NTNT has come out and said that they have changed their mind, that they are now, and again, this is how large internationals operate. And I believe that, and I don't know this for a fact, but probably that's when Jeremy decided that, he has handed over the reins of to a very large and established organization. He did everything that he promised. And in the absence of management buy-in, or perhaps, a regional responsibility, because he is, of course, one of those guys that has stuck around and been a dedicated and committed South African. I figure that, he decided in his personal right that time to go and do something else.
He's never actually commented on the speculation, but you're right. There has been widespread speculation that he was trying to lead a management buyout of some kind, where NTT would remain a shareholder, but that Dimension Data would become a listed entity on the JSE. And I suppose if that's what you've been championing for a number of years and it doesn't come to fruition, then you make a decision about whether or not you're going to stick around. And I suppose he made the decision to leave. Do you think he's going to pop up again somewhere? Do you think he's going to start a new business? I know I'm asking you to speculate here, Duarte, and it may be a bit unfair, but do you think he's going to go quietly into the sunset and retire, or do you think he's going to come back?
Duncan, I was an analyst. I specialized in speculating. Jeremy's a very healthy, sports-conscious guy. He's 60-something, and he looks like 40-something.
Yeah.
He's incredibly, and I don't, he has interest in wine farms. He has international network. I would be surprised, and I'm sure his family office has numerous investments in their personal right. I'd be surprised if he does not. In fact, I think it's virtually impossible for someone like that not to do something, whether it's ranging from charitable work to growing something new and exciting. I'm quite sure that he will do something.
Yeah. But just coming back to it's almost like there's two sides to the, maybe even three parts to the Dimension Data story. There was the period leading up to 2000 and the rapid growth and the fantastic margins and everything. And then there was the collapse from 2000, let's say, to the NTT acquisition in 2010, where they went through a very difficult time, where they were inwardly focused and turning around, trying to deal with the collapse in margins. And I think the fact that companies in South Africa, which pre 2000 probably saw IT as some sort of mystical thing that they didn't really understand. We need to get these boffins in from Dimension Data to help us. To corporate South Africa, I think taking a much more pragmatic approach to IT and realizing what it is, and actually it's not that magical. We just need to implement it correctly. So there was a very much a change in focus amongst corporate end users. But I think at the same time, the market became much more competitive from a Cisco perspective as well, didn't it? I mean, Cisco appointed a lot more distributors in the local market, and those margins after 2000 literally collapsed.
You're 100% right. There was a mystique in the 90s. And actually, interestingly enough, I think IT proliferated in South Africa almost as a consequence of sanctions.
Mm.
You know, the capability and a knowledge and a know-how that was created, other countries didn't experience this because the Americans simply parachuted in their subsidiaries.
Mm.
You know, if you think about IBM, they had a limitation. Hence, you had Hitachi have a market share in South Africa. You had Q-Data that had capabilities. You had Dimension Data that had capabilities. And they were able to leverage that. And also, as you say, you know, I remember Dimension Data buying TCO, a brand new entity that was listed for about 32 seconds. They paid 350 million rand for it, and it was 40 Microsoft engineers. So someone phoned me and said, what do you think of the deal? I said, you should have given me 40 million rand. I would have gone to a recruitment agency and paid 20 million and pocketed 20 million of profit to hire those guys. But the issue was they needed to move at pace. They said, we don't have the time. So it was cheap at the price. Because, as you know, there was this mystique. Your margins were running at 30%, 40%.
Mm-hmm.
As you had more people attracted to the industry, and the market then shrank post Y2K because there was no Y2K disaster, you know, the whole thing got commoditized, margins squeezed, and, you know, the resources became available. The scarcity of unique products like Cisco weren't that scarce. And so, you know, you had to move on to the next. But that's where Dimension Data was smart. You know, they jumped onto outsourcing with the joint venture with EDS when outsourcing was just proliferating. They jumped onto the internet. And what you were really banking wasn't Dimension Data as a Cisco distributor. You were banking on Dimension Data to find the new thing. And that's what they were good. And that's where someone like Richard Kamm was particularly good.
Yeah.
Go and shoot into the US and look at the trends. The beauty about South Africa is that we were 6 months behind the US, which enabled you to be not at the bleeding edge. So you could go out there, you could peruse and observe. Mm-hmm. You could see the next trend and then bring it back without the risk. And so what you were betting, and this is what you're betting these days on these massive companies, is that it's not that they're going to get disrupted, because you won't invest in technology because it's disruptive. If you don't think Amazon will ever be displaced, well, it's going to land up. You know, the law of big numbers says that at some point in time, it can only grow at 5 or 6%. They will be displaced.
Mm-hmm.
But you bet on the management team of their ability to identify, to invest, and to develop new ideas. And that's what Dimension Data was proving. That's why it was impossible to value it on the metrics that accountants love to do, PE ratios, discounted cash flow, because how do you measure the acceleration and ability to jump from one peak to the next? Well, you're going to make a judgment call. And that's why I introduced the thing called PEG ratios into this country in the 90s, because I said PE ratio is velocity. And if you're going to determine how long it takes a car to get from here to Pretoria, you've got to know the velocity and you've got to know the acceleration. And ultimately, you've also got to know what petrol it has in the tank if it can get there. Then you know how far it can get. And that's why it was instructive, but they become qualitative rather than quantitative. And this is where value investors missed it every time.
Mm.
This is why they've missed, you know, the Amazon and the and all these massive organizations that now exist, the Facebooks, have proliferated because you're not investing in extrapolating a trend of the past. You're presuming a trend into the future.
I was looking up on Wikipedia, and I know it's not the best source of accurate information, but I had a look at the Dimension Data entry on Wikipedia and had a look at who founded the business, and the names listed there, some of them I've never even heard of. I don't know if you know these names. Jeremy Ord, of course, but then there was a Peter Neal, Keith McLaughlin, and I don't think that's the current investment analyst, Werner Sievers, and Kevin Hamilton. Do you recognize any of those names?
I do, but, you know, ultimately, you know, many businesses get founded with many people. And by the time Dimension Data was ready for to proliferate, it was Jeremy. That's why, to me, it was Jeremy, and then there's the executives that actually took it. Those were the founders.
Yeah.
And there's The investment guy was Nick Frangos, who was a Mercedes Information Technology that actually was the backer behind. That's why Sunlum ultimately landed up as the de facto sponsor of this very large business, because they were the anchor tenants at the start.
I'd forgotten about Mercedes Information Technology, Nick Frangos. The Ellerines were involved there, weren't they, or am I remembering that incorrectly?
Then you went, was it Corp Capital that proliferated? So the Ellerines and Nick Frangos listed that financial services business, and there was a fallout between them, quite acrimonious, between a whole bunch of people when Nick Frangos had a falling out. I don't quite remember, but, you know, it landed up in an investigation and a parting of ways. But that's probably what you recall. Nick made quite a significant amount of money in the technology space before going into financial services.
Yeah. We spoke about Richard Kame. We spoke about David Frankel, who's a very successful investor now in the U.S. I think he lives in Boston. But there's some other names there that I remember. I don't know, Duarte, let me just throw a couple of names out there and see if you remember them and know where they are today. Peter Hurd?
Peter Hurd was probably the oldest of the team. He was responsible operationally for the networking side.
Yeah.
So he was probably the first to retire that I recall, you know, in terms of so I actually, I kind of see him on my Facebook portfolio, and I think he's the one that's done retirement properly.
Okay.
Doc Watson, Bruce Watson, Doc Watson, as he's commonly referred to, actually continued to serve in Dimension Data. And the last time I saw Jeremy in the offices, Bruce still sat outside Jeremy's office, and they were still partners, because Doc Watson, to me and to the market out there in the early 90s, you know, was always referenced as kind of Jeremy's partner.
Right. Yes, I remember. I never got to know Doc Watson very well, but he was integral to the business, and I think he's got a lot of interest in the wildlife space. I think he's he spends a lot of time working on private game farms down at the down near the Kruger. I forget the details, but I think that's his passion.
Yeah, but up until recently, and I think he was a low-key individual. You know, didn't
he was?
He really, was Scotty in the engine room, and but I think he probably stayed with Jeremy. As I understand it, Jeremy left the building yesterday.
Right.
And I would have thought that Doc Watson would have left with him at the same time.
No, he has. He's also resigned. He left.
It would have been at the same time.
Yeah.
And I also saw that Jason Goodall perhaps had already preempted this, because he'd announced that he was his last day would have been yesterday as well. Also, Jason, also fundamental in that business. Was another guy, Taylor, I can't remember his first name.
Taylor, yes.
He came from when Dimension Data bought SPL.
So he was on the software side of things, if I recall.
That's right. So he and Dirk Ackerman were part of the acquisition team that led some of the international acquisitions, including Bronze.com. So Dirk Ackerman is the other individual. If you remember, Dirk was the CEO of AXA. And then when Dimension Data was offshore, they brought on Dirk. All collectively good bunch of friends. So he's also done well.
It was Rob Taylor. I just Googled it.
Rob Taylor, yes. Yeah. Sorry, I just couldn't remember his first name. So
He's
continued to be active in the training and software side, and also charity work, done well. And then there were the Aptiakas, Ronnie and Alon Aptiaka,
as far as
investments of Internet Solutions. Ronnie, the movie maker. And if I'm not mistaken, Ronnie could well still be at Internet Solutions.
I know he has an office there. He has an office there for sure, and I think he goes in there. I don't know, since COVID, but he's definitely has an office at Internet Solutions, and he's revered there because he founded the business.
Well, look, I mean, his brother was a senior partner.
Of course.
Ronnie was a junior. But Alon, of course, the story goes that when Dimension Data bought the rest of internet solutions. First for 12 and a half million, then 375 million. Yeah. Alon and the youngsters also went to Sun City. Alon, who's not a gambler, but...
I've heard the story. I think you might have told me.
Machine and 1 million rand jackpot.
Unbelievable.
Crazy story, but true story.
Unbelievable. Isn't he a professional bridge player as well?
He subsequently became a bridge player. And yeah. then there was Ati as well.
Sorry, who?
The Ati brothers. There was Eli Ati and Lior Ati. And
Yes.
So they were also founders of the business.
Yes.
And, Lior subsequently went on to found a telecoms business, arbitraging airtime. I forget the name of it, but he's done particularly well.
I know the business you're talking about, but the name also slips my mind. Yeah, yeah, they've done very well.
The offices are here in the by the Wanderers.
Correct. Yes. Yes, their names have slipped my mind. The name of the business has slipped my mind. It'll come back to me before the end of the podcast.
and the names, Saku Misiokos, who then subsequently went on to head up IS and then and has also announced his departure.
Yeah.
He then progressed into the strategy role, you know, in the last 2 years. So he's also left. Also, Stalwart also done incredibly well. So
it was Angus McRobert as well. I don't know if you know Angus. He's also gone off.
Yeah. Angus wasn't a founder. A little bit of a story there is that, you know, I was at McCarthy Bank for a number of years, and then I joined up with the J&J guys, and I put together a joint venture with Internet Solutions to set up a black partnership there with J&J. It was all called ICOSA. So Gus was on my board. I had a CEO by the name of Rodney DeCock and Mano Quatera, and so J&J had a joint venture with Dimension Data / Internet Solutions, essentially to have a black-owned internet service provider, which we were reasonably successful with for a number of years. Ultimately, we sold that back to Internet Solutions. They bought us out, and J&J went on to buy a stake in Verizon in South Africa as the empowerment partners in Verizon.
Interesting. Gus, I think, has gone on to become an investor in the ISP market. He's got a whole bunch of ISPs. He's invested in other businesses as well. So I think he's done pretty well for himself as well.
So Gus came into Dimension Data. They had a little private equity boutique. Mm-hmm. And Gus actually came in from private equity. So he wasn't a founder. Came in and he landed up running that private equity portfolio and then kind of reinvented himself into the CEO of Internet Solutions at a point in time. Actually, when Brett Dawson went from Internet Solutions to the US to fix up Proxicom, Gus stepped into his shoes to run Internet Solutions.
And did a very good job by most accounts.
He did, and then, you know, he subsequently reinvented himself in kind of personal investments.
Indeed. So if you were to look back, and I know you've both covered Dimension Data as an analyst when you were at Merrill Lynch, but also worked very closely with the guys on deals and helping them where you can. If you look back at your history with Dimension Data, what are some of the highlights for you? You mentioned in your LinkedIn post about about jetting around the world and catching a flight on the Concorde as you were chasing down a deal. But what are some of the highlights for you of your time working with Jeremy and the boys?
Oh, you know, off the top of my head, because I didn't really think about this question. I guess the one comes to mind is, you know, I used to present to the guys the whole time. The one thing that the guys did superbly, Dimension Data executives were finely tuned to the investment community.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a reason why they interacted with you so well and with me so well. I mean, they were essentially talking to the constituency, which they did incredibly well.
Yeah.
So I used to present to them on the sector. They loved the Merrill Lynch link and the access to information. And one day I remember presenting to the executive team. I was often invited to present to the executive team in strategy sessions. And I was sitting at the Oval and, you know, I was engaging, and I saw this guy at the back called Jeremy Ord. And I saw him gazing out the window, staring out, and I thought to myself, you know, this oak just isn't interested anymore. You know, he's just, and I had my nose a little bit put out.
Okay.
It was only about 20 years, you know, and I continued to engage with him. So, but it was only 20 years later, I worked out why he was staring out the window. I'd underestimated how smart this guy is. The reason he was staring out the window is because I was waffling on and he'd already got it ages before. And 2 years ago, we started engaging with him on a prospective transaction. And, you know, it was only, you know, when I'm getting down to the detail. And then I'd be telling Jeremy one or two things. And I'm 10% into telling the discussion. He put up his hand and said, I get it. And I let's have a glass of wine. You know, and that's, you know, that resonates in terms of how smart a guy he was. Everyone thinks he's the golfer, ex-cricketer, sport. Yes, he is. He's a very congenial and likable guy. But he is, people underestimate how smart he is. So that's the one story. The other was, of course, on this deal because, you know, Dimension Data was a bucket shop. It was this aggregation of things. It was outsourcing. It was networking. Mm. It was a 25% stake. And then I was tasked to go and raise $300 million for them in Datacraft. First of all, I was briefed by the team in Sandton City. So I met all of the executives. Patrick Cornby is another guy that you should – already read their investment banking. Yes.
We can't leave Pat out of this discussion, can we? No.
So Pat, and I met the whole executive. They explained to me why they're doing the deal. And, you know, it was a secret squirrel meeting there in the Sandton bar, you know, which we shouldn't have met. And I remember coming down the escalator with Jeremy and we saw one of my competitor analysts.
Oh, yes.
Leslie Virgilotti.
I remember Leslie.
Coming the other way. And we were so scared that Les was very sharp. Yeah. If she saw it together, she'd work something was up. And I remember us hiding under the escalator, you know, as a collective huddle to avoid Leslie actually seeing us and working out that she's missing out on something, either she's missing out on something or that we're cooking up a corporate finance deal. So that was incredibly good. And then that Datacraft deal was something else. You know, Dimension Data was completely unknown overseas. SAB had managed to raise some money offshore. They had to place their shares at a significant discount to the VWAP. And I was tasked with going and educating potential investors in Europe and the US. And I landed up on a six-week tour seeing about 30 investors in Europe. And I was in Europe when Princess Di's funeral. It was an incredible sensation to be out there marketing at such a sad time. And then I landed up in the US. Arriving in the US on Concord, mm-hmm. I thought, gee, guys, these guys are really looking after me. Of course, after a couple of glasses of champagne, I realized the reason I was on Concord was so that I could arrive before I took off to fit in three meetings. I ended up doing three cities a day for nearly 3 weeks. I would literally get a ticket and fly into a city. I would get met by a limo and a salesperson, get taken to a new institution, present the story, move to the next meeting.
Sure.
So that we could develop a short list, eventually out of maybe 100 investors, investment institutions. I boiled it down to 30 interested parties in Europe, or 20 in Europe and 30 in the U.S., Then after that, our corporate finance team took Dimension Data executives offshore to go and see them face-to-face. So they would then go see the shortened list. And then we did a book build. And we did the book build. I remember the share was trading at 18 Rand a share. We placed $300 million worth of shares at 18 Rand a share. So that was a fantastic moment in 1997. And really did got them as a known entity to the international community, and it nearly killed me.
Fantastic stories. I think we could carry on talking about Dimension Data and the IT industry and your experiences from the IT industry for a long time. But we are running out of time, Duarte. I wanted to spend a little bit of time chatting about your history and your career background because you've done some really interesting stuff as well. You were the founder of Macquarie First South, which is a financial services institution, a bank, effectively, I believe. What was the genesis of that? Why did you decide to do that, and what did you manage to achieve with it?
Well, prior to that, I'd left Merrill Lynch. I'd been poached by a company called African Harvest that was backed by Coronation, and Peregrine to set up a private equity fund, which I did. We had a very successful period from 1998 to 2001. We then merged ourselves into McCarthy Bank, and there a well-known gentleman by the name of Jonathan Baer became effectively the anchor tenant. And we landed up doing, at the time, which was probably the biggest IT private equity deal. We bought out the IT assets out of Nail, called NAT at the time. And I remember we bought 360 million rand. And then we progressed to sell off the pieces. I landed up listing IOCore in Finland, and that was an exciting venture. But I then listing a telecoms intercarrier billing piece of software called Intech, which peaked at probably £1 billion market cap.
Good grief.
In that process, my partners landed having an almighty scrap over who owned what, and the fact that some of the partners had promised to do all their deals exclusively through McCarthy Bank and didn't. So that's why that entity it basically fell apart. We went our separate ways because we had a bit of a falling out in terms of how to divvy up the pie there. So basically, I was hadn't turned 40, I was 35, 36, and I needed to do something. So I was friends with Jay Naidoo, and he said, come and do some stuff with us. He said, I'm really not stepping into something new. I will help you do investments, and I will share. So I was effectively their chief investment officer, but not employed permanently. Mm-hmm. And then another colleague of mine by the name of James Slubbert, who was the top-rated banking analyst, said, listen, why don't we set up a financial services business? I said, oh, yeah, hell, why not? So we actually looked at buying Gensec at a point in time. We looked at buying Barnard Jacob Millet at the time. Mm-hmm. And eventually what came up is that Credit Suisse First Boston were pulling out the country. James and I went and negotiated with Credit Suisse First Boston, and we landed up buying their broking business. And we used that as a base to build the financial services business with J&J's backing, who in turn were backed by Old Mutual. So James at some point in time decided that he preferred to be, was offered something at APSA and became executive director, head of business banking. So he departed and left me with a few assets. Mm-hmm. I bought the outsourcing business out of specialized outsourcing. I bought a stake in an asset manager called Freighters Asset Management at the time. I had First South, which was the Credit Suisse First Boston securities business. And then in 2005, I decided that we needed a partner. The discussions with Credit Suisse became an all or nothing. So I decided that the latter was more relevant because I hadn't created enough value to sell. So I exited that. Credit Suisse went into partnership with Standard Bank, and I brought Macquarie into the country because they were prepared to work with us as a joint venture partner. So we formed Macquarie First South, which was at securities, corporate finance, private equity, and asset management. Ultimately, Macquarie then made me responsible for all of their operations in Africa, including the joint venture.
Okay. Okay. And when did you leave that business? What was the progression?
Well, I put a strategy together called Project Nile, which was really Macquarie's entree, proliferation into Africa. We thought we'd use this as a footprint. They liked my idea so much that they said, well, we need to own 100% of this thing. You know, and that's where, you know, there was a kind of conflict of interest because I didn't really want to work for someone. Mm. And I don't think I'm employable. So I said, well, we're going to buy it. We'll sell it to you. We entered into negotiations. And Macquarie bought our 50% with the idea of investing money into South Africa. I managed to exit and sell and be paid 7 days before Jacob Zuma fired Nene.
Oof.
I don't think the transaction would have been completed had that happened. Macquarie looked at this and said, well, this ain't good. You know, the money that we were going to invest, we're not going to invest. And sadly, the consequence of that was now they were stranded without an empowerment partner, the founder, and a change of mind in terms of deploying money into South Africa. I mean, just the unintended consequences of Mr. Zuma's
stupidity. Yeah.
But I got paid, and fortunately I then landed up being quite ill after that. So prescient and lucky, to be honest.
I wanted to touch on the health issues that you've faced over the last few years. You've lost your arm. What exactly happened? You had a rare health condition that eventually they had to operate. And I believe you almost lost your life.
So I had in my mid-20s a condition, a vascular form malformation developed in my left arm, which I was obviously born with, and it just got worse and worse. And effectively, the veins in my arm were swelling under high blood pressure. Okay. I had numerous treatments which, in hindsight, had been shown to be the incorrect treatment and aggravated the condition. So over, call it 30 years, I had probably 100 treatments / operations.
Sure.
Eventually, it got worse and worse. And just after I sold my business, it started to get really bad, incredibly painful. And I started needing active surgical treatments. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of those active treatments, I contracted the hospital superbug, MRSA. I was actually in a huge board meeting cheering it online when, and I already had it clearly, but I literally remember looking at my clock. It was 12 o'clock,
yeah.
And I remember waking up in hospital 3 days later.
Good grief.
I had a massive temperature. And MRSA is incredibly serious, with a fatality rate of 35%. I managed to survive that. But the problem was that the bug actually ate away the valve of my heart, and I needed open heart surgery as a consequence of that on top of. During my open heart surgery, you're messing around with the vascular system.
Yeah.
My arm essentially exploded. And so on and so on. I landed up many months in ICU, isolation. My heart stopped a few times, but clearly the devil had a restraining order and didn't let me in. So
I didn't want you.
And I actually wish that my arm had been amputated before I contracted all of these things.
Yeah.
The surgeon does acknowledge that we should have done it earlier, but it was dangerous because I nearly lost my life as well when the amputation had to be done. Mm. Again, you know, that's history. I came straight out of that into COVID lockdown, and I've spent a year recovering, and I'm fully recovered and causing trouble, as you know.
Well, I hope you've managed to avoid COVID after all of that, Duarte.
I have managed to avoid COVID. I'm not paranoid, but I'm very careful.
I'm sure. But I believe you're working on, you've gotten a bionic arm or some sort of electronic arm that you've bought. Take us through that.
Yeah, I call him Alfred because, you know,
Alfred.
Batman's assistant was called Alfred and he always gave him a hand. So it is, I believe, only one of three in the country. I got it last year. It unfortunately did set me back 2 million rand with zero assistance from my dear medical aid.
Good grief.
And it has been a challenge to get a fit because there are residual circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're nearly there. And, the fit, we've ultimately had to make a socket and attachment that is pretty unique globally for the billion-euro business called Ottobock that have produced this thing. Mm. I'll gladly show it off once it's Alfred has just come back from Germany where he is being serviced, and I'll gladly show him off when we're attached.
So I'm interested in the tech. How does it work exactly? I mean, can you control your Alfred's fingers and move them around with your mind?
Almost. I mean, There is a motor on every joint, so you get very articulated motion.
Yeah.
I've got an elbow. You can actually put a motor as well on the wrist. We haven't included that because the learning is too steep. But what it has, it's you've got a fiberglass cuff that goes over the stump, and attached. You've got electrodes on the inside, and effectively it either picks up a twitch of the bicep or the tricep. And you learn a combination. For instance, if I flex the bicep, the hand opens. If I flex the tricep, it closes. And then there is a whole bunch of pre-programs. you know, if you twitch twice, if you twitch three times, and you can actually program it on your Bluetooth. For instance, I'm a keen photographer, and there's a whole bunch of motions. So I've got, you know, a fixed tripod that I travel around with, which is called an arm. And, you know, I've got specific motions, and I program it with my cell phone, and I can use that specifically. So, for instance, if you'd like to do this particular motion with your fingers, you just program it once as two twitches of... And so it is literally a cyborg. It's one step away from you think it and it happens.
Incredible. Do you think at some point in the future you'd get to the point where you could maybe use a computer keyboard with both hands?
So, yes, absolutely. And in fact, in the trial run, you know, there is a sensor on the finger that allows me to actually type on my phone. And absolutely, you know, I can put the finger, I can control the finger, I can control all of the fingers in every joint, and I can control putting out the index finger or two fingers. In fact, I can pull dirty signs, which I've done out to my this car, which Autobox said I found a way to crack the code because they programmed it specifically that you couldn't do rude gestures.
So you hacked it.
I've hacked it.
Oh, I love it, Dora. That's brilliant. I'm going to have to meet Alfred when he comes back from Germany, and you can show me everything he can do, because it's very, very cool tech. Very, very amazing what they can do these days. But I'm really sorry you had to go through all of that, all those health issues, and you've literally been through the wars.
Yeah, I have. But as I'm back, and like I said previously, I'm back and causing trouble. And, I've got a number of very exciting projects, other than those that are in the public domain.
Sure.
But you know, right now, you know, I guess now the frustrating thing is third wave of COVID, and I really now I'm into the second year of isolation, and I really
frustrating, you know,
the more I'm isolated, the more trouble I'm likely to cause.
You just get into trouble on the internet instead of in person. On podcasts like this one. Excellent stuff. Well, Dwight, it's been fantastic talking to you. Before we go, you do have some interest in the IT sector. You're the chairman of Huge Group, which, of course, is in the middle of a bidding war for Adapt IT, which is a JSE-listed company. Do you see yourself becoming more involved in the IT space going forward again?
So, you know, it's interesting. When I departed from Macquarie First South and Solid, James Herbstum, who I've known for 25 years, contacted me almost within minutes of the Bloomberg article coming out. We had breakfast and he said, would you like to do that? Funnily enough, I had just, the last thing I did in Macquarie First South was as part of my business, not directly, but we listed capital appreciation SPAC. So I had every aspiration of doing a SPAC in South Africa before Jacob screwed up the equity capital market. So James asked me to join the board. I thought about it. He said, go and think about it. I came back over Christmas and said, I've thought about it. Interesting. I don't want to be part of an Altex company. I'll join if you join the main board. Then he said, well, I was actually lying. If you're going to come on board, I'd like you to be the chairman. I said, well, in for a penny, in for a pound. Why not? So I then thought, gee, you know, this could be an interesting vehicle. And you might recall I actually had to get together with the CFI. I landed up with an option in Huge. So Huge was very much part of my involvement. Of course, then I had a two-year period where I went from quasi-executive, because the last thing I did effectively for Huge was help them raise the money to do the ConnectNet deal. We did a 450 million rand raise, and at the time, the interesting thing that kind of tickles me, when I got involved with Huge, they had a turnover of 200 million rand, a profit after tax of 20 million rand, and a market cap of 400 million rand. Exactly what I mentioned Data had in 1994. So it tickled me that I was getting involved with the group at that point in time. So that tickled me, and then, in my mind, this could be a vehicle to do what I wanted to do, because the SPAC story, to do a SPAC in South Africa, just vaporized. And I was doing some things in agriculture and the like. And so I've become more and more involved. I had a 2-year kind of leave of absence where I became a proper non-executive through my illness. And I'm not executive, but I'm very, very much involved with Huge, and in particular, this Adapt IT transaction. It is
Where do you see that deal going?
We're going to be successful. You know, you did see the scheme of arrangements getting with the Valaris getting passed yesterday.
I did.
But, you know, we were quite clear in terms of what our intent was. We didn't need a controlling interest. Our offer is better than the Canadian offer. You know, we've got into a little bit of a bidding war. I do believe we're offering something special. I do believe we're offering participants of Adapt IT continued exposure to the markets. Right now, what's happening in the global tech markets, I mean, this feels like the 90s all over again, just for a different reason. Mm. You know, there's buckets of money available out there that support good ideas. I believe that you have to have the right instrument, critical mass, and that's really one of the primary reasons why we thought that ourselves together with Adapt would be a collectively big enough to go and tap into the opportunities that exist here and the money that exists offshore. So we already are getting acceptances. Mm-hmm. You know, there's still a number of, the regulatory challenges have not been inconsequential, and there have been many obstacles. We didn't expect an international foreign competitor to us. It is what it is. In some ways, it makes us feel good. You know, if a company like Constellation that has worth tens of billions of dollars could identify the same, could see the value that we can see, kind of substantiates our filtering ability. And, you know, 12 million shares voted against the scheme yesterday. Those have clearly got to be people that that are in favor. 50 million didn't vote. Mm. You know, we do believe that we're going to land up with a significant minority stake, and that's a good starting point. We're not upset. If Constellation of Valaris land up being alongside us, that's not a terrible thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, interesting. So you'll stay a shareholder post this, even if Valaris gets control?
Valaris have got effective control.
Yeah.
I mean, what we do want to do is effectively provide the Adapt IT shareholders with a continued exposure to the upside through a listed instrument rather than just taking the cash. Remember, Adapt IT will probably stay listed because, you know, we will ensure that it is if we've got sufficient votes. If it doesn't, you know, we will stay there. And of course, you know, if we have a significant minority stake, you know, we will be able to protect our interests and work alongside them in terms of the international expertise. So I see it as a win-win situation. Mm. Hopefully, you know, because of the complexities and confidentialities, I mean, we have not been able to interact with them. And we look forward to being able to interact with them.
Yep.
And also to interact with the Adapt IT management team, which we've been precluded from talking to. Because I do believe that they think that we're kind of, you know, the big, bad, vicious wolf.
Yep.
Actually, we're much less than potential international investors. You know, we need the management team. We need to work with them. The idea of being together by de facto means that we need those people.
Yeah.
It's not so clear that an international $30 billion company needs anyone except to take the intellectual property. So and remember, I've dealt with international partners. You know, they're not the savior. They're there for a reason. They're here to create value. And we will hopefully protect the South African intellectual property. We'll protect investor interest, and we'll leave them exposed to the upside. So I'm excited about it, and I do think we've already got enough shares to meet our minimum criteria. In theory, we've already succeeded, but I think we'll succeed with a significant minority stake.
Yeah, interesting. Can you work with a management team that has been openly hostile to your bid, though?
Duncan, remember, it's only two people.
Yeah.
That have spoken about this. I mean, the CEO has got, I wouldn't want to comment about, you know, his challenges.
Sure.
I mean, I've always been particularly concerned about the fact that he owns 100% of a property that he's leased back to a company for a 13-year lease. So, yeah. I mean, that's going to be a challenge, but we will work with it. You know, I'd like to unpack that. And then there's Tiffany, who's the acting CEO.
Yeah.
So we have not engaged with I do believe that there's this fear. We have not engaged with anyone. Mm-hmm. We have got no animosity to either of those. I mean, we wish we would have been able to talk to them. At the end of the day, we spoke directly to the people who own the business. And that was always our intention to perhaps, that's classified as hostile, I guess. But at the end of the day, you know, I think corporate M&A in South Africa has been too clubby in the past.
Yeah.
We wanted to go and talk to the owners, but the idea was never to be one of animosity. For this to be successful, we have to partner with the team. So yeah. We will work with them, and I do think we can.
Yeah, it's been quite an interesting bid all around in that, you know, you've also put out those, if I can call them attack ads, having it was almost an American sort of approach of marketing to Adapt IT shareholders and saying, you know, we're better off together, put out these videos on YouTube. I know one of the regulators told you to take the videos down from the huge group website, but it's we're seeing some interesting corporate activity here that or types of corporate activity through this deal that we don't normally see in the South African context.
It's exactly what I said. It's been a bit of a clubby mentality and kind of we're all going to do handshakes. Mm. You know, it isn't by chance that we followed the American approach. You know, it's a proven method, and I do think it was time to shake it up a little bit. But really, I mean, why we had to go to the public media like that?
Yeah.
Adapt IT have got known, had effectively very little. I mean, we're made up of institutional investors and very little retail.
Mm.
The plus side of that is when we want to go and do corporate activity, we go and talk to where the money is.
Yeah.
You know, the downside of not having that is that, you know, you've got to go to the mass retail market. So they have in excess of 12,000 shareholders. Mm. You cannot communicate on a roadshow to that base. We had to go to the media. And yes, we had to comply with the regulator, but we did not use information that wasn't in the public. Yes, we were a little bit punchy. And I think it was, I think everyone has reverted back and said, you know, that was just so enlightening. That was just so refreshing that you're prepared to do that. You know, we've got a message. And the message is that we're better off together. The message is don't be stranded in an entity where you can't control your interests. We believe that. And, you know, the regulator had a view that it was an announcement. I don't understand that.
It did seem a bit silly.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to comment on that. You know, the regulator's entitled to do that. I'm just not clever enough to understand how communicating public information is an announcement, but we pulled it in compliance with. Of course, social media went crazy after that.
Yes.
But we complied with what we were told to do.
Mm. Mm. Fascinating stuff, and we'll know the outcome of this whole Adapt IT pursuit in the coming weeks, right? There's a meeting in mid-July where it's all going to be decided.
Yes, there was the scheme of arrangement meeting yesterday, which you've noted has been approved.
Yeah.
And the numbers were very interesting to us. You know, of course, Valaris is not working with a hedge fund by the name of Black Sheep. There's no concert party there, of course. But they voted. I can imagine someone bought shares at 7 rand to sell at 6 rand 50 just because they like someone. So on the 13th of that was approved. Yeah. On the 13th of July, there will be our general meeting because, we have to get a category one approval. And then by the end of the month, our offer closes. So between now and the 31st of July, you know, we need to get a message out to the Adapt IT shareholders who have not given irrevocables, because you can only choose one option, that there is an option that instead of taking... Remember that the Valaris deal is still subject to a whole bunch of conditions precedent, including Reserve Bank approval, Comcom approval. And let's just remember that Burger King has not achieved that because it was a foreign entity taking out a local entity. So you cannot give this 100% certainty. So if you go their offer, you will get 7 Rand in December or later, maybe. If you take our offer, you get effectively 1.37 times your shares in Huge, which you can sell in the market immediately. You know, I know liquidity is an issue, mm-hmm. but you may have seen there's been some big block trades that have happened off market recently, and that shows that we've got institutional support who have deep pockets. So you can take that, you can be exposed to the joint businesses going forward, or you can sell, you know, immediately. You don't have to wait till December for maybe. So those are the messages we need to get out there. We do hope people will take it on the ratio. We did change our offer significantly based on the independent report. And we had to talk about that long and hard because, you know, there was new information in the market and there's also, you know, a whole bunch of noise and ugliness around the CEO that we had to consider.
Yeah.
But ultimately we went to the limit to say, look, this is not where we're trying to buy something cheap. We had an idea on value and we had been told what that value was, incidentally. That's why we used that number of 5.52. We didn't invent that. Remember at the time, last year the share was trading at a buck. No one was interested in it. So we made the offer, and then we had the independent. That independent would have had access to management Adapt IT, which we didn't have. So we offered the peak price as a demonstration that we want to pay the right price, not a cheap price. Valaris increased the offer from 6.50 to 7 Rand, even though the valuation is somewhere between 7 and 9. Mm. Sounds like they're trying to get a cheap price to me, but, you know, who am I to say?
Interesting. So your involvement in Huge Group, do you see... I know that Huge Group has said they're planning to list in London. Clearly, James has big ambitions. Do you see Huge Group with you helping as chairman becoming a much more significant player in the ICT market in South Africa?
I mentioned to you that there is a mountain of money out there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the cash in hand, if you look at the evolution of the retail invest in the US, you look at market volumes, you look at the SPAC activity. You know, it is ideas and quality investments that is lacking, not money. I believe that you can access that money if you give them the instrument that they need. It's very hard for a retail US investor to invest in South Africa or other. You know, they've got to go through the institute, the tax obstacles. I mean, it looks like it's seamless, but it isn't. Mm. You know, people want to be able to, therefore we want to tap into those global, whether it's through Europe, whether it's through New York. You know, you want to give them the instrument that they want so that they can deploy money into the, we believe that the region offers significant opportunity. There are the whole disruption around telecoms, mobility, X-Tech. We are positioned to come. We are small. But there are, as an instrument, we can provide a conduit for investment. And I'm very passionate about that. I'd like to be involved. And certainly with my experience as an investment banker, I would see fit to deploy, if I was requested, to help in growing a huge to be of sufficient scale to be attractive for money, and then A, to attract that money, and B, to deploy that money in successful acquisitions to grow and develop the opportunity in the region.
I wanted to ask you, talk about the money flowing through the system in the US at the moment, and certainly the valuations there are very interesting at the moment. You've lived through the dot-com bubble, the 2000 crash. We're seeing Microsoft, we're seeing Apple with market caps above $2 trillion. We're seeing Tesla with a market cap of $600 billion, which I think makes it about 10 times the size of VW, or worth more than, I think the figure I saw was worth more than the top the next 10 car makers combined. Do you think that we're in a dot-com style bubble in the US right now, and do you think it's going to burst?
You know, even a stop clock is right twice a day. The market will crash. Correct. The higher it goes, the more it's got to fall. Yeah. I mean, there's without question. But that doesn't mean that those companies, you know, notwithstanding the dot-com crash, just remember that Amazon was founded in 1995 and now has a $2 trillion. It was founded through that. It was founded with the capital that it accessed. You know, the valuations do seem incredible. They do seem heady. Mm. But I mentioned to you that if you try and value these things on the basis of equilibrium or accounting standards, you're never going to come up with a valuation. What we have failed to recognize is the platform effect, the network effect, whatever you want to call it, Metcalfe's law. And that is, you know, I remember when, because Merrill Lynch was involved in Amazon, it was just a bookstore that competed with Barnes & Noble. No. An analyst got fired from Merrill Lynch for basically calling Amazon a sell, because he said, you know, they're going to have to sell probably every book in the world to justify this valuation. Right. What he failed to recognize, and I'm not even sure that Jeff Bezos, whom I met in 1995, I'm not sure that he even realized that he was going to become a platform. Right. And so, you know, the disruptive effect, the revolution, it all sounds like buzzwords. But we are undergoing that, and there will be a creation of new value. And you know what? Some of them are going to crash and burn. There was lots of crap that listed in 1999,
yeah.
Me included, doing some stuff in South Africa. And there's lots of crap that's getting listed now. It smells the same.
Yeah.
It feels the same. The difference here is that I think you've got a post-COVID economic recovery that I've never seen before.
Mm.
You've got a zero interest rate environment, which I've never seen before.
Mm.
Yes, inflation's a risk. You've seen savings here in excess. These stimulus packages.
Mm.
This economy, the market, is it expensive? Yes. Is it going to stay expensive? Yes. Mm. How long? I don't know. I worked out somewhere in December, November that this window is going to stay open for at least 18 months.
Mm.
It's still 18 months. So I don't see it. You know, beyond that, it's just too far to see. But in that time, you can go and get support for great ideas. You can build great businesses. You can aggregate and you can create a whole bunch of revolutionary businesses. That's what I'm excited about being involved in Huge, because Huge could be the kernel of something like that. AdaptIT brings in intellectual property that could add to that. You know, and there are others that we would like to, but you need access to real money.
Mm.
And actually, the sad thing is, it's almost easier to raise money offshore to invest in South Africa and Africa than it is for South Africa. You know, the fund managers are here, unfortunately, are chasing index, so they don't support anything outside the top 40.
Yeah,
and then they're all promoting. And we're all guilty of this, you know, looking over the fence and trying to export our capital. I mean, Rob Herzhoff has just, and his team, Bradley Doyle, have just raised $360 million for a SPAC to invest in gold production facilities in South Africa and Africa. Now, from my world as a technologist, that's pretty damn boring stuff. But it's important.
Yeah.
It says that. I tell you what, how much do you think you'd raise from South African institutions for that? So it's indicative that the money does want to be deployed in the right vehicle for Africa and South Africa, and it's probably, you know, profits are always recognized outside of their hometown rather than in their hometown. And I do believe that South African Africa is a great investment opportunity, especially in a world that is short on ideas. So the valuations, yeah, relative to the rest to America, are cheap.
Mm.
Let's help them invest in the continent by respecting the vehicle that they want to. A Huge represents an example, not the only example. I've just mentioned the gold SPAC. I do believe Cartrack went the other way. They're just delisted in South Africa and moved. Look at the valuation that offshore people are prepared for exactly the same asset.
Yes, and much higher.
We've done that to value our own assets. Adapt IT was trading at a back last year. All of a sudden, we make an offer this year, and everyone's interested. Yeah. And now we're guilty of trying to score a cheap price. But we're offering five times the price it was a year ago.
Yeah, it's crazy, this market. It's
in this market that our institutions are not prepared to recognize.
Hmm.
You know, we need investment in this country. I'm passionate. I'm in South Africa not because I'm here by default. I've had many opportunities to emigrate and to depart. And I'm here because I'm excited about the people. I'm excited about the opportunity. And I'm excited. What Dimension Data did in the 90s, where they exported, people said, gee, these guys know how to do something. These guys are exciting, not because they're networking, but they can see the next opportunity. Mm-hmm. They can jump on the next thing. They are able to see it. They are able to take a developed world and deploy it in a massive emerging world. That's what they really did. Why can't we do that again?
You almost need a switch in the energy of the nation, if I can put it that way. I think people are so depressed and conservative and not willing to invest because of the 10 years that we've just been through, where there's just been so much destruction and stupidity, stupid political decision making, et cetera, that I think businesses here are just sitting back and taking a wait and see approach. Is this country actually going to fly again? And when it does, then maybe they'll start investing, but they really are sitting back and not investing right now. Do you think that's a mistake in your view? Do you think that business people here are being too conservative?
You know, like I said previously, we're all human.
Yeah.
And we all get despondent. And, you know, what we fail to see, and if you're an international investor, you know, you have an MSCI index. And you say, well, you know what? I invest in 20 emerging markets because I like the story. The developed world can only grow if they get access to the emerging market, resources and food, which is here. And the continent. So the developed world is going to grow. Well, not if they can't get the raw materials out of it. So that's the first thing. You know, we get so tied up in our day-to-day problems. They say we understand emerging markets as a good market. We understand that there's 10 good markets in the world. We are going to deploy 1% in each one of those markets. Some of them will be basket cases, others won't. So they don't get into the minutia that Jacob Zuma has been indicted and going to jail. They say it's an emerging market. You know, as they say in the classics, poo happens. Doesn't matter. You know, it happens in all those emerging markets. We are taking an asset allocation process. You know, we have not only are we not deploying our own money, which I think because of that pessimism, we are making it harder to invest.
Yes.
And the JSE is a great, respectable organization, often top three exchanges in the world. Unfortunately, that also means that it becomes hard because of they've not facilitated investment into the country.
Mm.
That's why I'm saying it's almost easier to raise money offshore to deploy locally because they'll take a portfolio approach. You give them the vehicle that they want rather than the vehicle we want to give them. We are the taker of money. We're not setting the rules. So I'm not clever enough to work out why they support SPACs, why they do valuations. I'm just going to give them an honest opportunity and give them the ability to deploy their money. Once you do that, you know what will happen? The South African institutions will follow.
Yeah. We've
got one of the greatest resource bases in the world. We've got we haven't done development mining for 15 years in this country.
Mm.
The South African junior miners are listed in Australia and Toronto because there's a problem with our asset management fraternity. There's an aggregation. The problem is if an asset manager in a large institution deploys $10 million in a junior miner and it doubles in value, it does nothing for his performance. But if it halves, he loses his job. The concentration in our market is a problem.
Yep.
Therefore, they almost have, by default, they're not going to support developmental players like this. Mm. Whereas, almost easier to go and get foreign money for local deployment. When you get to critical mass, the institutions have to follow and support those entities after the fact.
Yeah. I think let's wrap it there. I'm going to ask a final, perhaps a little cheeky question and try and bring the conversation full circle to where we started talking about dimension data. You're very clearly keen to get back into deal making and into business, and you're showing interest in the IT sector again. Jeremy Ord is at a loose end, if I can put it that way. He's left Dimension Data, doesn't have a full-time job anymore. Do you see yourself and Jeremy potentially working together on something in future?
I'd have to let him answer that. I'd love to. I wish the opportunity, I hope the opportunity arises. I did get Jeremy and his executives a couple of years ago to invest directly in Huge. We did try to do a transaction together there.
Oh, yes.
Some of those executives are still invested on our share register. So I have a good relationship with them and others. I'd love to work with Jeremy. I'm not sure if the feeling's mutual. I hope so. And time will tell. I've obviously got to come up with a good idea. And, of course, as you point out, the poor guy is on his last penny and probably is desperate for some unexpected fees.
Not. Oh, yeah. Excellent stuff. Well, Duarte, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know we have run quite a bit over our allotted time, so thanks for taking the time out this afternoon. But I think it's been a fascinating discussion, and I'd love to invite you on again onto the podcast at some point, and perhaps our viewers can meet Alfred as well.
I look forward to that, Duncan. Thank you very much.